workshop. I hope you've enjoyed all the talks so far, and I'm sure that we'll enjoy the three remaining talks that we've got today. First up, we've got Jean-Philippe Vert. So, Jean-Philippe, over to you.
Thank you. So, thanks a lot, the organizers, for this amazing workshop and allow me to be here. Actually, I'm not really an expert in change point detection. Turns out I'm working more in machine learning and computational biology. But at some point, we did some work related to change point, and I try to show today some applications and motivations for change points. And also, so what interests me is typically working on biological data where we have very long signals. So we have things related to change point detections where the bottleneck is the length of the signal, and we're looking for efficient algorithms for doing that. And you know, this week we talked a lot of very fast binary segmentation-like algorithms that are fast but not optimal in a sense. And on the other hand, more accurate models like dynamic programming-based things, which find a global optimum but are a bit slower. They don't scale to full genome size. And what I will discuss today is some methods inspired by the fused lasso that I see them as a way to bridge a bit the gap between these two alternatives, to be fast and still reach a global optimum. Okay, so first let me motivate a bit, because it's early morning, I shouldn't start with the questions right away. So what's my main research interest? I'm working in a cancer research institute. We focus on, you know, studying biology, and typically the kind of questions we ask us are when we have a cancer, you know, cancer is made of cancer cells in someone's bodies. And typically the questions we ask are when a cell becomes a cancer cell, what went wrong? What are the causing factor for the cancer, how to treat it? And one way to do that is to look at these cells. So you could look at them like at the microscope. So on the left you have some normal blood, and on the right you have some leukemia blood. So there are differences in the shape of the cells. But nowadays we look more inside of the cell, and typically one thing which is quite striking is that when you look, you know, within each cell, you have within the nucleus, you have the chromosomes that encode the DNA for each cell. And I suppose you're aware that in most of your cells as humans, you have 23 pairs of chromosomes, which are depicted, this is called the karyotype, on the top. So this is what a normal cell looks like when you look within the nucleus. And when you look at a cancer cell, very often you see that things have changed at the level of chromosomes. So these are like big changes. Like for example, in this case, you may see that for chromosome 7, you have not two copies, but three copies. In fact, it's a bit more complicated because we call that chromosome 7, but you have two normal chromosome 7s, and one of them is not really chromosome 7. It's more a fusion between part of chromosome 7 and part on some other chromosomes. So it's well known that you have this rearrangement of the genomes, and these things is related to the property of the cell to be a cancer cell, meaning to proliferate and have things that make a bad. So naturally, it's, you know, if we have the possibility to do it, it's interesting to look at as many samples of cancer cells as possible. For instance, to look at these pictures and try to make correlations between how the genomes was reorganized and the property of the cancer, and perhaps highlight positions in the genome that are critical for the development of the disease, or particular architecture that could be predictive for the risk of relapse and therefore to adapt the treatment, etc. Okay, so of course we don't look at these pictures because it's not easy to get these pictures, and you know, the resolution is very bad, but what has been around for a few years now are technologies. So here I just show one technology called a chip, DNA, a microarray. This thing is now replaced by a newer technology called sequencing. But basically what they do is, instead of taking this picture and showing the karyotypes of the chromosomes and how they're reorganized, they capture something which is less informative but still easy to get, which is what's called the copy number. So this is the kind of profiles you get. Imagine this is a summary of your full genome. So here you have chromosomes from 1 to 23. You have vertical bars which are between chromosomes. So in a sense, you have 23 independent signals that we collected one after the other here. And you have in the vertical axis, what you measure is the log ratio. So it's normalized at 0, but it's the log ratio between the number of copies you have in your cell and the normal number, which is 2. Meaning that if you had a normal cell, it should be a flat signal here at 0, just to show that it's a normal cell with 2 copies of each chromosome. And here is a cancer cell. And for example, on chromosome 1, you can imagine that part of it has 2 copies. So you have like two copies of the beginning of chromosome 1. And then you have visually a change point, and it jumps to a higher number, perhaps 3, meaning that you have 3 copies of one part of chromosome 1, which is related to this picture here, which could be, for example, on chromosome 7. You would have 3 copies of the top of chromosome 7 and 2 copies of the bottom. This is what it represents. So of course, there is less information here because it doesn't tell us who is connected to whom. But by the way, with now the new sequencing technologies, we have ways to also not only to measure the copy number, but also who is fused with whom. So this is richer information. But in this talk, I will just talk of this data. So we have this data, and the thing is, these data are cheap to get. Getting this data costs, so with a microarray, is around $100 now. You've heard of the famous perhaps company 23andMe that does your genotype. This is what they use. So if you pay $99, you send a sample of your whatever part of your body, and you get in return this kind of pictures. So this is the copy number, and you can also measure the mutations in your DNA, etc. Okay, but the idea is very cheap, high throughput. So you get that in a few hours, and now so here in this kind of chip. The typical length of the signal is a few hundred of thousands, because we just in these chips they just sample some position on the genome, and with the new technologies we sequence all the genome, meaning that we have a measure that potentially has order of 3 billion. So we have 3 billion letters in the DNA, and we can measure the copy number of each letter now. Okay, so you potentially have a signal that for each position gives you how many copies of this letter you have. So this is a challenge, because we need to manipulate this data. So we talk of terabytes of data, of raw data, processing is hard, etc. And in particular, from this picture, you already see that there are questions related to change point, or at least analysis of these piecewise constant and noisy signals. So I will quickly, in this short talk, I will quickly discuss 3 problems that that are of interest and that we try to address. The first one is really the main goal of this conference, perhaps, is if I give you this signal, can you design an algorithm and a method that's able to identify change points and quantify, so assuming it's piecewise constant plus some noise, can you identify the change point and the underlying signal? It would be like the low-level processing of this data. It's very useful, and in fact, both the value so the level of the black curve is important, and the position of the breakpoint is important. If we can identify breakpoints, very often we can associate the position of the breakpoint with the position of some important genes. Typically, there are some cancers where 2 genes of 2 different chromosomes need to get near each other in a new chromosome to become a cancer. So if you can identify the change point at some positions, it may reveal the position of fusion genes. Okay, so this is very important. And it's really like the direct question of change point detection here. Now we also discussed the 2 other problems which are important and for the application, and which I think can borrow techniques from the change point analysis. One of them is when you don't have one signal but many signals, and typically so each of these signals would correspond to a sample, a patient, and you ask questions like, for example, here, these are real data of melanomas. So this is a skin cancer. And on the left, these are profiles that were measured on patients that I called aggressive, in the sense that this is a disease that was first cured by surgery, and then a few years later, it relapsed. So it's about the bad case. And on the right, these are diseases where after surgery, the patient was cured, meaning that after 10 or 20 years, nothing new happened. So a question which is called the question of prognosis in medicine is at the time of when you see the disease, you try to cure it, can you predict the risk of future evolution? What's the risk of relapse? And in the case of cancer, this is the most important part, because most often cancer kills after the relapse. Okay, so a question is, perhaps there is signal, there may be information in the genome that is predictive for the risk of relapse. And for example, if I give you this time series, I call that time series, but there is no time. Let's call that time series for this talk. Can you see a difference between the time series on the left and the time series on the right? Can we make a predictive discriminative model to discriminate them and make a predictive model, meaning that for a new patient, we would measure its profile and be able to predict if it's aggressive or not? Okay, so this is typically a problem of machine learning, or in statistics is a supervised classification, and we'll see. I'll discuss a bit how you can use change point detection tools as a building block to design algorithms for classification of profiles. And finally, the last point I will discuss quickly too is which is I think more the title of my talk is the following: when you have several profiles. In the case of cancer, it can be discussed, but there are cases where you see frequent positions with frequent change points, meaning that across many samples, it's not always clear, but here, for example, you have a change point at a position which is repeated in many cases because, indeed, it corresponds to positions of important genes which you want to detect. So we can formalize this as if I give you these many samples, or you can see it as one multidimensional signal, can you detect efficiently positions or change points in this multidimensional signal? And what we are interested here, so typically here, you know, when we want to do statistics or asymptotics, we will assume that the length of the signal is fixed. It can be large, but it's fixed. And what will increase is the dimension. So we have, suppose we have more and more samples, more and more patients. Can we make an algorithm that will benefit from increasing the dimension, so the number of profiles, in order to better detect what are the common change points? I will formalize it a bit more later. Okay, so the rest of the talk is to study quickly each of these problems, and in particular, of course, there are hundreds of methods that you could imagine for that. I will just discuss what we've been working on, and more precisely, so we've been working on techniques related to what's called the fused lasso, which I will describe now, and which, again, I don't want to oversell them. There are many competitive or good methods, but I see this one having interesting properties in terms of finding an in-between in terms of fast method that still managed to find a good solution. Okay, so the first problem is the one we've been seeing many times this week is I give you a signal and I want you to find the change points. And what I want is to have a method that runs in 2 seconds for profiles of 10 to the 8 on my laptop, okay? So I cannot, unfortunately, I cannot even, I think, PELT is a bit too long. All the quadratic programming based methods are a bit too expensive for that. So you could say, well, ideally, so I will make a very simple model, assuming it's piecewise constant plus Gaussian noise. You can, of course, change the thing, have likelihood, etc. But so let's look just at that. Suppose you want to say, well, can I find the, so if y is my signal, I could look for my best approximation beta that has at most k change points. I will use these notations here. So this is just the L2 distance between your approximation and your original data, subject to the constraint that there are at most k jumps in the vector beta. It's well known that this is an optimization problem over a combinatorial number of partitions, but that it can be solved with dynamic programming in quadratic time, okay? So this is the very standard dynamic programming to segment a signal. Okay, so this thing is very nice. It's huge to win from p to the k to p square in terms of complexity, but it's in some applications it's not enough. So how can we be faster than that? And typically, how can we be linear in the length of the signal? This would be the goal, to have a segmentation method that scales linearly with the length. So I will describe now this idea of fused lasso, which we did not invent, of course, it was here before, but just to try to explain it, we can see it as, you know, in statistics, in machine learning, there are, when you're confronted with a combinatorial problem, typically of feature selection, so when you want to infer a vector with just a few non-zero components, typically, instead of looking at all possible subsets of k non-zero components, there's been a technique around for quite a few years, and which is very popular, which is to make a convex relaxation of the problem with a convex penalty, in this case, to talk of the L1 norm of a vector. So when you have an objective function, a smooth convex objective function that you want to minimize, but you want to find a sparse vector beta, so a vector beta with many zeros that minimizes this objective function, then a useful trick is to penalize it with the L1 norm of beta. And this thing will have the effect that you can play with this lambda parameter, so the importance of penalty. This will have the effect to find a solution which is not the global minimum of R, of course, but which is a minimum which is sparse, meaning that many of the coefficients of beta will be zero. And an intuitive way, visual way to understand that is to say that if you have, so if you look at the L1 norm, the set of vectors beta with a constrained L1 norm is a L1 ball like this, which as opposed to the Euclidean ball is not a circle, but it's a square in two dimension. And so when you minimize a smooth function subject to the constraint that the L1 norm is bounded, you can either find a solution in one of the edges, which has nothing particular, but in many cases you will find a solution in one of the non, you know, singularities of the ball. And these points here, the four singularities, are exactly the points which have one zero coefficient. Okay, so if you generalize it to higher dimension, you will see that if you minimize a smooth function over the L1 ball, then quite often you will end up in a singular point of the L1 ball, and these are the points which contain many zeros. Okay, so it's a trick, but it's very computationally interesting, because this thing is a, if R is convex, becomes a convex optimization problem, and there are many efficient methods to solve this kind of problems, and therefore directly to, you know, to do feature selection at the cost of just a convex minimization. So this is the standard L1, so it's called the lasso, typically in statistics. This is the standard L1 trick to do feature selection. Now, how does that relate to our change point problem? Well, if I go back here, you see I said, well, the basic problem is finding the best fit to our data subject to a constraint that we have at most k gems. Okay, so this could be a candidate for convex relaxation, meaning that instead of constraining the number of change points, perhaps we can constrain the L1 norm of the change points. And so the L1 norm of the change points would just be the L1 norm of the increments, which as a name, in fact, is just the total variation of the signal. So this is something even older, I think, than the lasso, which is to say that if you have a time series or a vector beta indexed by a one-dimensional index, then if you minimize an objective function, a smooth convex objective function penalized by total variation, then you can show in the same way as the lasso that the solution of this problem will most of the time be piecewise constant, in a sense that it will be sparse at the level of increments. Most of these beta I plus 1 minus beta will be zero, like for the lasso that puts the coefficients to zero, and this thing will be piecewise constant. So it's like a computationally efficient trick to have an objective function and find a vector beta which will end up having a potentially small number of change points, so it should be piecewise constant. Okay, so this idea, so total variation has been around for many years, and in
more recently it was really proposed as a method to treat this data. It's called the fused lasso, so I called it the total variation signal approximator, but it's really, so if in addition to total variation, you also penalize the L1 norm of beta to not only be piecewise constant, but also to have many of the values to zero, then it's called the fused lasso. I forgot the thing.
Ready? Okay. Okay, so it was in particular proposed by the Tipsherani and colleagues as a way to find a piecewise constant approximation to some data. Now, what I was interested in is what's the complexity of solving this problem? Because as opposed to feature selection, we already have a quadratic, so dynamic programming is quadratic algorithm to solve the exact problem. So this convex relaxation only has some interesting property if it can be faster than dynamic programming. And the general way to solve a quadratic problem is at least quadratic. Okay, so in fact, in the first papers about the fused lasso, it was proposed to be solved as a quadratic program, which is not faster than dynamic programming. And in 2008, the first paper, it took 2 hours to segment a signal length 10 to the 5. So it was not faster than PELT, so there is little interest in doing that. But then there were a few interesting ideas, and in particular, so I got to this problem listening to Zaid Arshawi's PhD thesis. So in some of this paper with Levi Le Duc, he showed that if you look precisely at the problem of the fused lasso, then there are many computational tricks that you can apply. And in fact, so I'm not really sure of the complexity, but it's something like PK or P log PK. We have to discuss about that, but typically it's something so. So in Zaid's works, to find each time you want to find the next change point, then you need more or less to scan the signal, so to have a linear time complexity and perhaps a log p term to sort the things out. But you completely decrease the complexity from p squared to p or p log p. Okay, so what I will it's a minor contribution, but discuss now is in fact that you can be even faster than that. Just there is nothing very, very strongly new. But if you look in more detail to the algorithm proposed by Arshawi and Levy-Leduc, there are some parts of the algorithms are superfluous, meaning that if you just focus on what's important, you can reduce the complexity. And to make a longer and technical story short, in fact, what you can show is that these fused lasso, or this total version approximator, can be solved exactly by a binary segmentation algorithm. Okay, so binary segmentation historically is the algorithm where you have a signal, you scan it using some statistics to find a change point, and then you isolate the left from the right and you iterate. Meaning on the left you scan it to find the next change point on the left, on the right you do the same and you iterate. So these things are very fast. They have complexities length of the signal times log of the number of change points. Okay. Now, what's interesting is that these fused lasso, so solving this problem, which really doesn't look like binary segmentation, it's really a convex optimization problem. So you want to find the global minimum of this problem. To solve it, to solve it exactly, it's enough to solve, to implement a binary segmentation algorithm. A bit different from the standard one. So typically, you can write it down. You define a statistics, you have a, I will not go to the details, of course, but you can write a specific statistics and then plug it into binary segmentation to really take your signal, scan it once to find the first change point of fused lasso, and then do this on the right and on the left independently to find the next change point on the left, on the right, etc., and iterate until some criterion is met. Okay, so it's a bit surprising. So by the way. I don't know where it's. So we worked on that, and it's also related to a paper by Hoefling, which was published in Tech Report in 2009, which shows a bit the similar result, but the other way around. So showing that in order to find the complete set of solutions of the fused lasso, you can start from a fully sequenced sequence, meaning a change point in each position, and then you can merge some pairs of segments one by one, and there is it's just a merging operation that leads to the set of solutions of the fused lasso. So binary segmentation is when you start from no change point and you add them, and Hoefling talked about the other way around, when you start from all the segments and you merge them two by two with a rule and you have a way to reconstruct the tree. Okay, so this thing can have a few consequences. So a good news, of course, a practical good news is that if you want to solve the fused lasso, then you should do that, and you end up with a fast method to solve the fused lasso. Another good news, potentially, we did not investigate that, but is that now we have something that is binary segmentation. So usually binary segmentation is called greedy. You're not sure to have the global optimum, but here it's a binary segmentation scheme whose solution is probably the global optimum of a convex optimization problem. So if you want to study the properties of this solution, of this binary segmentation algorithm, then you can use all the tools and statistics of minimizers of an objective function, M estimators. Okay? Now, on the other side, the bad news, and again, we did not investigate that more, but shows that this total variation approximator is no more than binary segmentation. So if there were some comments this week that if you see someone doing fused lasso, you should be skeptical because it's not supposed to be good. It's maybe related to that. So this particular total variation penalty has the property, for example, that once a change point is chosen, then it remains in the solution in all subsequent segmentations, as opposed to dynamic programming, for example. Okay. Nevertheless, it's quite interesting to see this possibility to define really an optimization problem and find the global optimum in a very fast way. And it's really so. If you're interested in other applications, we also did some work on hierarchical clustering. When you do hierarchical clustering, you also have these two kinds of methods. One is so you have just data, you want to find clusters. You have the fast but greedy hierarchical methods, where typically you start from the full set of data, you split them in two, and then you, each cluster you subdivide it in two, etc., to get a dendrogram, so a description of your data. And on the other side, you have an p-complete method like k-means, where you try to find a minimum of an objective function. But this is very hard because you need to optimize over all partitions. And you can use a bit the same ideas of making a convex relaxation of k-means that leads to fast algorithm. And so we did something called a cluster path, which is defining a convex relaxation of cluster of the k-means that probably leads to a hierarchy of clusters. So it's a bit like this segmentation. You can solve it efficiently because it amounts to dividing your data in two and then in two again, etc. And you get a clustering, which is also the whose partition is the global minimum of some specific objective function. Okay, I will skip, of course, the any technical detail. But again, if you're interested, it's ask Zaid how he worked his paper using the LARS, and just to remove the unnecessary steps of the LARS, because you need to scan the full signal to find the next change point over a window. Okay, so when you do that, the kind of results you get on a laptop is now it's like binary segmentation, so there is no problem to run it on 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8. Long signals. It takes 2 seconds for 10 to the 8, 10 to the 7. So it's really it can be used for real applications. And for example, we borrowed this tool to make so a more complete set of tools for segmentation of sequencing profiles. Doesn't mean it's the best tool, but at least it's one binary segmentation tool that allows to scan very long chromosomes when you have hundreds of millions of positions. Okay, now let's move on to a second, and this will be short, an extension of that, which is this question of more machine learning question, which is, can we suppose I give you this time series on the left and its time series on the right, and I want you to make a model to discriminate them, and more importantly, this model should be able to classify, so to predict if you have a new signal, if it belongs to the left or to the right. Like here, it's again, these are a cancer with bad prognosis or good prognosis. And this is important to be able to predict the prognosis. So there is a huge literature on supervised classification. These are just, time series are vectors, so you can use any method for classification of vectors. But here, skipping the details, what's interesting is that you could say, well, what about, so if you see this, each profile as a vector, probably the simplest or the most direct methods for to make a classification is to think of linear classifier. So linear classifier would just mean that you need to learn a weight vector. A weight vector would be a profile itself, and you would do the inner product between your weight vector and each of the signal. And if the inner product is positive, you would say that it's on the left. If it's negative, it's on the right. And the goal is to infer this weight vector. So this is a linear method. Okay. Now you can try to think of this can be a very high dimensional learning problem. So you need to put constraints typically, or perhaps to use some prior knowledge. And here in this application, you could say that if we believe some biology there, you could say that probably the difference between aggressive and non-aggressive cancers may not be just some property of some part of the genome. That typically, if you imagine that the aggressiveness is related to a few genes or a few modifications of the genome, then you could say that what you want is to identify some regions of the genome that would contribute positively or negatively to the aggressiveness of the tumor. And therefore, you could say, well, what about trying to learn a linear model, which would be sparse, meaning that you don't want all positions to contribute to the aggressiveness. You would have to identify a few positions. And also, because of this one-dimensional organization, perhaps to find sets of positions which form a region here that would say that over this region, if we see that a profile has large values over this window, then aggressiveness is more likely, and conversely, it could be negative somewhere else. Okay, so if you translate this idea mathematically, it would mean that perhaps you may want to learn a weight vector to make your linear classifier. That would be sparse, meaning zero most of the time, and piecewise constant, meaning that it would identify windows with positive or negative weights that would correspond to regions responsible for the aggressiveness of the cancer. Okay, so how does that relate to the change permutation problem? Well, one easy way to implement that, once we know what's the, you know, about fuse lasso and total variation, would be to say, so in standard machine learning, typically what you do is that you have an objective function. So here, I don't want to explain the details, but you have an objective function. So here, beta would be your set of weights that you want to learn. You have an objective function that tells you whether this vector beta is good at discriminating the blue from the red, so on the data you have. So you have a way to measure that. It can be logistic regression, the logistic loss, or it could be spot vector machine. And then you have you need to add a penalty because you're in high dimension. And here, instead of using standard penalties like in rich regression where you penalize the Euclidean norm of the vector, you could just say, well, let's penalize this total variation and L1, so this fuse lasso penalty, in order to constrain the model I learned to be piecewise constant and sparse. Okay, so here the goal is not really to identify change point in a signal. It's really to use that as prior knowledge to constrain a model. And because it's a convex function here, you minimize the convex loss to a convex function, and you will learn a model which at the end should be sparse and piecewise constant, so which potentially could identify regions of the DNA responsible for your classes. Okay, so so here there is, I just wanted to make a tiny comment here, which is that when you're confronted to that, then you need to design an algorithm to solve it. And again, we optimize over a vector of length 10 to the 8, so it can be a bit expensive. But something interesting is that when you use this kind of, you know, convex and non-smooth penalties, one type of methods which is quite popular nowadays in large-scale optimization are the so-called proximal optimization stuff. So it's a generalization of gradient descent, but with things which are not differentiable everywhere. And what's interesting is that at the, you know, as a key routine of these proximal methods, what you need is to be able to compute the proximal operator. And the proximal operator is exactly solving this problem with, as an objective function, the one we saw earlier, which is you have a target vector and you want to minimize the distance between beta and your target vector, penalized by this. So this is exactly what we do when we have a vector, you know, a profile and we want to find change points. The fuse lasso minimize this function with a particular loss here, which was beta minus y square. This thing is, if you can solve that efficiently, then you can plug that into the proximal methods in order to solve a more complex problem where you can fit any loss function here, any convex loss function. So in a sense, once you can solve efficiently just the approximation, so the change point problem, then you can plug that as a subroutine, like it's equivalent to the computation of the gradient in a sense. And the rest of the method allows you to minimize this more general problem. Okay, so this is a very nice byproduct that that gives a fast method to solve this very high dimensional optimization problem and machine learning problem. And so I don't know if we can. So this is just to give you some illustration of the kind of models we learn. We'll not discuss the biology at all, but if you have good eyes, you may see on the top picture. So again, this is the genome. You have 23 chromosomes with vertical red bars, and you have a blue line here, which is the model we have learned. So the things we want to see is that it takes zero values. Like in chromosome 2, it only has zero values, meaning that for the prediction of aggressiveness, it was considered that chromosome 2 doesn't play any role. It was sparsified to zero. And then it identifies regions, like here it's chromosome 6. You have the beginning of chromosome 6 has very strong and positive weight, meaning that according to the model, this part of the signal plays a very important and positive role toward aggressiveness. So this kind of model, you know, starts to be interpretable because you can look at that. It identifies the regions, it gives them weights, etc. So that's the kind of model that are really interesting for these kind of applications. Okay. Now I'll move on to the last part, which was the title of my talk, which is trying to focus on a different problem, related but different problem, which is finding shared change points. So it, again, each profile is one patient, so I accumulate data over many patients and I want to find frequent chromosomal aberrations. Another way to mathematically describe this problem is to say you have a multi-dimensional signal. Each one is a dimension, and you want to do change point detection in a multiple change point detection in a multi-dimensional signal. So that's what you want to do. You have three signals. you know, and you want to, so this is a, you know, the toy, really the toy model we use. We have three signals. They share this exact the same change points. And here the idea is that you see, for example, if you just had the third signal, there is a change point here, which is very hard to see because of the noise. But if you compare this to this, you can see that, I mean, thanks to the other dimension, you can detect it. So that's really the goal here, to borrow strength, statistical power, by increasing dimension. So, you know, our motivation here, technically, was to say, well, so we have this nice trick of the fuse lasso for one signal. Can we use it in with two or three signals or more signals? And so we can, you know, start the same way and say the standard dynamic programming could work. So in standard dynamic programming, you would say, so now I have my observations y, which is now not one signal, but it's a matrix. Like so here are representation n. You have n signals of length p. You try to approximate it by another matrix, and you want to constrain the number of jumps, but multidimensional jumps. Okay, so to solve that, we know that this can be solved efficiently by dynamic programming, but still that it doesn't scale to the very long signal. So we would like to find a fast method to solve that. And here, so can we use the same trick as fuse lasso? Remember, in fuse lasso, what we had here is that we had k jumps, and we said let's replace the number of jumps by the L1 norm of the jumps. Okay. Here, the jumps now are multidimensional. Like you have a vector of 3, and the question is, from the vector of time of dimension 3 at time t and t plus 1, is there a jump? So you cannot use the L1 norm of this thing because it's a three-dimensional jump. You need something else. And this something else exists. It's just the Euclidean norm. So this is related to you know, moving from one signal to many signals in statistics corresponds to moving from L1 norm to select one feature to the equivalent of L1 norm to select groups of features. Like suppose the features go 3 by 3, you would like to say, I want to select this group of 3 features. And one way to do that is to use this fuse lasso penalty, group lasso penalty. So the group lasso proposed by Wang and Lin a few years ago is an extension of the L1 norm to vectors, which are, so imagine here, W is a vector made of dimensions, and imagine you by yourself you have defined a partition of the of the dimensions. Let's suppose you partition the dimension 3 by 3, then the group lasso is simply the sum of the Euclidean norms of the vector restricted to each group. So this is perhaps a more visual illustration. Suppose you have a three-dimensional vector and you decide that the three dimensions are grouped in two groups. The first two coordinates are grouped together, and the third coordinate is a group by itself. Then this group lasso penalty is simply the Euclidean norm of this two-dimensional vector, which is this, plus the Euclidean norm of the last vector, which is exactly the absolute value. Okay, so this means in particular that if the groups are singletons, this is the L1 norm. And if the groups are not singletons, it becomes something more complex. And intuitively, you know, I showed a picture earlier that with the L1 norm, you have the square, and therefore, when you optimize over the square, you end up in some of the singularities which are sparse. Here, the same story happens, but the singularities, like this is the ball corresponding to this norm. You see that you have singularities either on the horizontal circle, which means that the third coordinate is 0, so it means this group is 0, or you have singularities at the top of the cone here, which are points for which the first two coordinates are 0, so this group is 0. Okay, so more generally, this penalty is a convex trick in order to, when you optimize subject to this to the constraint that this norm is bounded, is a way to learn a vector W that will be 0 by groups. So here, we can plug that into our problem and say, well, I want to find change points, and for me, I want to control the number of non-zero increments. Perhaps I can replace the number of non-zero increments by the group norm corresponding to this increment, so which in practice means you made the sum over all the positions of the Euclidean norm of the difference between the vector at t plus 1 minus the vector at t. And if you minimize this, so this objective function with this constraint, then the solution you can show will be piecewise constant in p dimensions. Okay, because it will be sparse at the level of groups, and the groups are the multidimensional increments. So it's really the generalization of the fuse lasso. Nevertheless, it raises a few questions, and it will be the I mean, I will conclude with these questions. I mean, show some answers. So questions are, can we implement that efficiently? Again, there is this question of, if it's not faster than dynamic programming, probably doesn't make much sense. So we want to make that faster than P square. And perhaps we can do some theories, like when you do that, can you say something about the recovery property? Like if the number of signals increases, can you show that this kind of method will find the good change points? So I will give a few answers to this question. So the first answer is about the implementation. So it turns out that the tricks that were used for the fuse lasso, so I said the fuse lasso is binary segmentation, here it's not true anymore. It's more complicated, and part of it is because, you know, when you play with the lambda parameter here, so the regularization weight, if it's in one dimension, then the solution path is piecewise linear. It's not true anymore in higher dimensions. So many of the trees don't work anymore. But still, and again, thanks to Zaid's knowledge in tricks of linear algebra, it's possible to design methods that are linear in the length of the signal. So I skip the you know, if you're interested, you can discuss later. But typically, you can exactly solve that with a block coordinate descent method. And the reason why it's linear is because, and this is ugly, but you have, you know, huge tricks. Like when you look at this particular problem, the design matrix has the property that you can take the design matrix transpose itself, invert it, and still compute it in linear time. So this is something, if it was a generic design matrix for a group lasso, you would not be able to solve that efficiently. But because of this particular design matrix, then many of the operations are linear in the length of the signal. And at the end, you end up with fast methods. OK, so we can, you know, it's much slower than the fuse lasso, but still it scales linearly. And we can apply that to the kind of signals we have. The final things I will mention is, it's not really complete, but it's the beginning of some theoretical results you can say. So what about the property of the change point you detect with that? In particular, when the dimension increases, can you say that you localize more precisely the change points? You can make a small model, and here there is a problem that appears, which is, I think, well known with the fuse lasso, which is that if you just penalize the total variation idea, so the multidimensional total variation, then you are not consistent and you have boundary effects in a sense, you know, because you don't control for the fact that the effect of noise is more important at the center than near the boundary. You can show in practice that if you just look at the first change point, for example, which is easy to analyze, then you are consistent, meaning that when the dimension increases, you will find it more and more precisely, only if it's not near the boundary. And this distance to the boundary is related to the noise. Okay, so when you have large noise, then it gets more and more difficult to find a change point near the boundary. And what you find is a systematic bias towards the center of the signal. In fact, an easy fix to that is to replace the total variation by a weighted total variation, which is with a weight which is the common weight we recover in all, you know, QSOM-like methods, where when you make the QSOM, you need to normalize by where you are. And if you plug that in the total variation, then you are consistent throughout the profile, meaning that at least the first change point will be the good one, and with probability tending to 1 as the dimension increases, with the same speed wherever you are in the signal. So this seems to be a nice fix, but this is not, there is something hidden here, which is that this will work for the first change point, but then this thing will find the next change points, and they will not have the correct normalization. So there is something a bit, this is why some, you know, fuse lasso is not good in a sense. It's because it's not able to apply this normalization to the successive change points it finds. Okay, you can make a few experiments and show. And so, you know, this kind of experiments show typically that when the number of signals increases, so here I think it's just for a single change point, but the probability to find a change point really increases. We see differences between, so this is when you don't weight, you see that the position of the change point has an effect, which is corrected once you take the weighted version. So with the weighted version, wherever the position, you find it at the same speed. And also we have experimental evidence that for multiple change points, we are consistent if the noise is not too high. So these are curves that for when you have 10 change points show that increasing the dimension allow you to correctly find the 10 change points if the noise is not too high. Okay, I will conclude here. And so, in short, you know, I try to bridge a gap between this binary segmentation and global optimization thing. So the FusaSO is a particular example where binary segmentation meets optimization. There are a few many open questions. So I didn't discuss at all the number of change points. Once you formulate your problem as a optimization regression-like problem, then you can use all the theory of model selection, which may be a bit specific to these penalties. And other things that could be interesting are when you have time series on a network, so it's multidimensional, but you have one signal in each node of a network, then you might have other constraints in terms of computation, like who can communicate to whom, etc. And this kind of techniques could be perhaps adapted to this setting to make efficient procedures for multidimensional time series on a network by changing a bit the penalties. Okay, I'd like to thank Kevin Blickley, who is my co-author, for all this work. And if you have any question, I don't know if we have time, but I would be happy to take some.
Time for one quick question. So, I guess for me, on the network side, I mean, it's just a more a generic extension. There's not necessarily a bioinformatic type application.
Yeah,
there.
Sure. Yeah.
I just wondered whether you could see any applications for where you might use that in
biology.
Yeah, in biology.
Well, no, it's not obvious where I would have time series on nodes of a network. So there are a lot of networks in biology. You have the time series. It's not obvious where you have a problem with time series on a network.
Okay, let's.
Thank you.
Thank you.